This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The middle class seems to be the mantra of this year's elections, from the presidential candidates to state races, for governor, Congress, the legislature, and on down. The contenders all talk about the struggles of the middle class, how their policies would bolster this group, and how the other party's platform would threaten middle class families, arguments that were on full display in last week's presidential debate.
The people who are having the hard time right now are middle-income Americans. Under the president's policies, middle-income Americans have been buried. They're just being crushed. Middle-income Americans have seen their income come down by $4,300. This is a tax in and of itself. I'll call it the economy tax.
Well, I think let's talk about taxes, because I think it's instructive. 4 years ago when I stood on this stage, I said that I would cut taxes for middle-class families. And that's exactly what I did. We cut taxes for middle-class families by about $3,600. And the reason is because I believe that we do best when the middle class is doing well.
While the numbers do suggest that many in this income bracket have lost ground over the past decade and are not doing so well, there are questions about how much ground they've lost, why that happened, and what the middle class's own responsibility is for its diminished plight. Today in The Exchange, measuring middle class malaise. We'll find out who's in this group, how they're feeling these days, and why. And let's hear from you, too. What do you make of all the talk about a beleaguered American middle class? Does it reflect your reality or not? Are middle class problems getting enough attention from our elected leaders, or too much attention? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests joining us for the hour. From Durham is Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center and an associate professor of political science there. And Andy, good to have you. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Also with us in studio, Dennis DeLay, economist for the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies and New Hampshire Forecast Manager for the New England Economic Partnership. And Dennis, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Charlie Arlinghouse, president of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, a free market think tank based in Concord. And Charlie, welcome. Good to see you.
Hi.
Well, gentlemen, let's just start with a measurement, if we could. And I'll start with you, Dennis. Now, technically, I've read the middle class is defined as 300% of poverty level, adjusted, of course, for family size. If you've got five kids, it's different than if you have one. But can you give us an idea, Dennis, of what numbers we're talking about here?
Okay,
can you do that?
Again, going on that definition, about half of the Americans have incomes that are above 300% of the poverty line. And the way that the Census Bureau defines it, and some other researchers have defined it, in 2011, for a family of four, they need an annual income of about $68,000 to qualify as middle class. I think where things sort of get confused here is not only whatever the definition of the middle class is, not only by the Census Bureau, but also how people define themselves,
right,
and where they seem to think they fit, whether they're middle class or upper middle class or lower middle class. I mean, most people, as surveys have shown, that most people will self-identify as being in the middle class, including about half of the Americans that make more than $100,000 a year.
So just on the numbers one more time, and I do want to talk about that middle class as a state of mind, not just an income level. So $68,000 for a family of four,
yes,
up to what, Dennis? At what point are you no longer middle class? You're either wealthy or poor.
Well, that's debatable. You know, again, it's a matter of perception. People, you know, somewhere around $200,000 to maybe $500,000 a year, I think people would normally think of as defining themselves as being upper class, but not always. Again, you know, people that make over $100,000 in a Pew Research report tend to identify themselves as middle class as well. I think the other number that gets thrown around a lot and misunderstood is the median income number. So, and I think that's what people tend to be talking about when they sort of say, well, there's this number that shows the middle class has lost ground. What they're really, I think, talking about is median household income or median family income, which is the midpoint, you know, the halfway point between there. So that means half of the people make more than that and half of the households or families make less than that. And that median has fallen in the last couple of years. In New Hampshire, the median family income in 2011 was $62,647, and that's down slightly from median income in 2010, which is about $62,770.
You know, I want to pick up, Dennis, on what you said and ask Charlie what he thinks. The idea that there are people who most of us might not define as middle class, either they fall under in terms of income or well above in terms of income, but they still define themselves. Yeah, I'm middle class. Why is that?
It's hard to say exactly, but no one likes to be rich and no one likes to be poor because rich people are them. And you know, we all don't want to think of ourselves as, you know, we're not those kind of people. We're not aristocrats. And we also don't want to think we're poor. So we're not upper class. We're upper, lower, middle class. And we're lower, middle, upper class. And you run a – you know, if you look at statistics, we do – a lot of government statistics are broken down by quintiles, or they divide the country into five pods, each fifth. And so in theory, the middle of those quintiles, if 40% of the people make less than your group and 40% make more than your group, you are middle class. And the average of that group is about 50 grand a year in terms of family income, household income, you know, you and you and your husband or you and your wife combined. You know, that's – let's just say for the sake of argument, that's about 35,000 on the lower end and 70,000 on the upper end. I know people where – there are two of them, they have no kids, and they're both making six-figure incomes. And they think of themselves as middle class, yet 98% of the country has a lower household income and higher expenses, basic expenses anyway, than they do. And yet they think of themselves as middle class. It's because I'm not a Rockefeller. And nobody ever wants to think of themselves as a Rockefeller. And by the way, at the lower end, no one wants to say, well, I'm lower class, because that sounds bad. It's, you know, we don't mean it that way economically, but it sounds kind of bad. So I might be working class.
What does that mean, by the way? Is working class about income? Is it a state of mind? Is it a choice of profession? What is it?
Everything's a state of mind. We're all working class, right? Because I work. If you don't work, you're not working class. But if you work, you know, in America, everyone wants to, you know, we all work and we earn our living and we, you know, we like to get our hands dirty and all of that kind of thing. And so you know, brain surgeons who work on their car on the weekends and things like that. So, you know, working class just means I'm working. I'm not, you know, I'm not getting a handout. I'm not, you know, I'm not living off a trust fund. I'm a working guy. I'm a working stiff. And, you know, I have beer and pretzels at night and all of that kind of stuff.
Andy Smith, what do you make of all this? Not only the pure definitions of middle class that Dennis gave us, but the broader idea that we all kind of want to be in this group.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, that America, and coming from Britain as well, has been a middle-class country for an awful long time. In the United States, we historically haven't had an aristocracy. You know, there are some wealthy families that have existed over time. But most people consider themselves as self-made people. It's a good thing to be thought of in America as somebody who's brought yourself up on your own, and you typically do that by working. And you don't want to be seen in the upper class. Unless you are absolutely there, and then you probably just don't want people to think of you at all. You want to stay under the radar. But I think what Charlie was saying about the lower class is absolutely the case. People are aspirational in the United States. They want to think that they're going to be doing better. You don't want to characterize yourself as lower class, because the perception then for even yourself psychologically will be that you're not going to get beyond that. So middle class is a nice place to be. More than half of Americans consider themselves middle class, but I think you'll be talking more in the rest of this show that there are huge distinctions economically within the middle class, and particularly educationally within the middle class. And I think that's where a lot of the problems that we're seeing today are occurring.
Well, and Andy, I want to ask you about how you hear this concept of middle class being talked about in the campaigns this year. I mean, I've listened to so many debates, talked to so many candidates, looked at a lot of campaign ads, and if I had a quarter for every time these folks say middle class, you know, I could maybe bump out of the middle class and move up to the upper class. I mean, is this unusual, Andy? I mean, are candidates this year talking more about the middle class than before? Or is this just standard boilerplate for anybody running for public office, no matter what the year?
Well, certainly since World War II, politicians have been focusing their messages to the middle class. And they do that for several reasons. First off, it's the economic engine of the country. It's most of the people being in the middle class, and the work and small businesses are, the workers and small businesses are in the middle class. So that's where the money is generated. That's who typically pays taxes. But most importantly, from a political standpoint, that's where the votes are. And politicians are, if most of the people in the country who vote consider themselves middle class, it makes absolute sense for a politician to pitch their message to that group.
What do you think, Dennis? How do you hear, as an economist, how do you hear about the struggles of the middle class being talked about this campaign season?
Well, I think that, again, if you look at the numbers, the numbers suggest that there, you know, if the question is where did the middle class go, that's probably a relevant question. And if you look at the data seems to suggest that people have been moving equally up into sort of the higher income groups, as well as, you know, moving down a little bit into the lower income groups, and the split's been about even. So, you know, the economic data does tend to suggest that you know, there are fewer people, you know, from a measurement point of view, in this middle group. And I think
so it's shrinking. The middle class is shrinking.
It's probably shrinking, but the data seems to suggest that, yes, there's a portion of that group that's moved down the ladder, but there's an equal portion of that group that's moved up the ladder as well, even though they may not perceive themselves being that way. I mean, I think there are a lot of issues that we keep hearing about that seem to indicate that the middle class is under a lot of stress. Discussions about pension reform, discussions about unionization, the discussion we're having in New Hampshire, have had in New Hampshire about right to work. People, I think, have tended to self-identify with people that in manufacturing industries and construction. And actually, those are the industries that got hardest hit in the last recession.
All right. Well, lots more to talk about after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls too. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Your thoughts about the status of the middle class and how it's being talked about during this political season. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. More of the exchange coming up in a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan on challenges still facing U.S. schools. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy across the state with a chance of an isolated shower along the seacoast. The North Country could see some breaks of sunshine. Highs today, 53 to 58 degrees. Tonight, lots of clouds, some patchy fog, lows 30 to 35 in the north, ranging to 40 to 45 in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Dartmouth Hitchcock, now proudly working as a member of the Mayo Clinic Care Network to change the future of healthcare. Information at dartmouth-hitchcock.org/dhmayo. And from North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, online at northbranch.net. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the status of the middle class. Who's in this group, who's not, and why it seems to be a political football this year. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. What do you make about all the talk of a beleaguered middle class? Is it your own reality or not? Are middle class problems getting enough attention from our elected leaders, or too much attention? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Charlie Arlinghouse, to you again, what do you think about that question that I asked Andy Smith earlier? You know, are candidates really talking more about the middle class this year than ever before, or is this just standard campaign fare?
I think this is typical. If you go back and look at things like You look at the 1992 campaign. Every Bill Clinton's commercials for the longest time all started with the line, it all begins with a middle class tax cut. And Paul Tsongas had a, I think what he called a call to economic arms. And in that, he talks about a beleaguered middle class. You go back further than that, you go back another 15 years before that, and Ronald Reagan's radio addresses, if you read them, which is where he laid out who he really was, he talks constantly about the purchasing power of the middle class, the effect of inflation on the middle class. And I suspect, I haven't gone back and checked, but I suspect that the Kennedy-Nixon debate probably included a lot of lines about the middle class, too.
Yeah. Andy, you want to jump in there?
No, I think he's absolutely right that the middle class is a good spot to be politically because, boy, the candidates certainly are looking for your votes. This is not particularly unique, although it may seem a little bit more so at some times in the times that Charlie mentioned. The times of recession, candidates will talk more about the middle class because the middle class likely is going to be hurt by recessions and they're going to be more interested in economic issues. So I think that's why you may be hearing, may seem that you're hearing a little bit more about it now, largely because when the economy's bad, that's all politicians talk about.
Well, and here's a question that stirred up a lot of debate recently. And Dennis, I'll start with you, but I want to ask all of you. This idea of the so-called lost decade of the middle class, a Pew Research Center study late in the summer found that since 2000, the middle class has shrunk in size, fallen backwards in income and wealth. I think the subtitle of this Pew report was Fewer, Poorer, Gloomier. It's a really,
really
zingy title there. But what do you think? Do you agree with this overall analysis, Dennis, that this last decade, never mind the financial crisis and the recession that happened in the late 2000s, that this whole last decade has kind of stunk for the middle class? What do you think?
Well, again, I think you can't answer that question without considering the Great Recession and the impact that it had, and a lot of those losses, you know, in terms of income, the decline in median income that I was talking about earlier, and probably most importantly, the loss in housing wealth that most Americans who own homes experienced, are all tied into that. I mean, I think you have to parse that decade a little bit. And most of that loss did occur in the last 4 years or so. And it's more than perception. I mean, again, there's a lot of pressure on wages. We've seen housing prices nationally decline by about 30% in 3 to 4 years. So, again, I tend to think that the average guy on the street is pretty smart and gal on the street is pretty smart about what they really think is going on in the economy. They may not have all of the numbers that I've been spouting in the last couple of minutes, but they pretty do much know if they've got a better job now than they had maybe 3 or 4 years ago, if the neighbors got a better job. So people's perceptions of the economy, I think, are pretty accurate.
Yeah, and the costs of middle class values like health care, decent health care, an ability to send your kid to college, Charlie. I mean, even if your income isn't doing too badly, those costs have gone up a lot and they eat into your budget.
Well, costs of a lot of things have been going up. I do want to make a point about things like lost decades. We make a point of when we compare things by comparing them in terms of a decade. For example, we talk about the 1990s, and we talk about them because all of those years have the one thing in common, that they all begin with the number 9. And they don't necessarily have a lot else in common. Now, it happens that in the 1990s, we underwent an economic expansion from about 1982 that's the 80s, 82 to 91. But the second recession, the recession of 1990, began a little slow at the beginning of the decade. Then a big boom didn't begin until 2000. So a lot of things peaked around 2000. The 2000s, if we call them that, have the disadvantage of having two recessions in them. So if you look at any 10-year period that happens to have two recessions in it, it's going to look bad. In fact, if you look at the other day, just on a lark, I decided to graph the average income of the middle quintile, what you might think of as the middle class, the middle 20% of America. I graphed the average income, and there are it's a typical graph. It goes up, and then it comes down. Then it goes up some more, then it comes down a little more. Then it goes up some more, comes down a little more. Each of those downs is a recession. And if you look at the periods of time in between the downs, we did great. And if you look at the recessions, we did badly. So the middle class does badly when there's a recession. By the way, so does everybody else. And that's the deal. Are there issues related to things like healthcare and things like college education? Actually, that's probably true. I think in terms of 50 years ago, my mother put herself through college. Her parents moved to California. They had she was lower middle class. They had no money, and they said, "You can stay behind, but we can't give you even $5 a week." So she paid for an apartment, all of her living expenses, and college tuition, working as a waitress and in the print shop at the university.
Wow.
And you can't do that at any college in America except the work-study college in the Ozarks today.
Well, and Andy, I want to get your thoughts on this, too. But I also want to take some calls. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is great, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And Gary's up in New London. Hi, Gary. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm curious, as I was born in 1960. I had a stay-at-home mom. My dad worked for a large corporation and ended up owning his own business. When I grew up, most of the kids around my neighborhood had stay-at-home moms. Now, my wife and I both work. We have two children. I'm curious about the middle class today as compared historically, I guess.
So is it harder to be in the middle class today than it was when you were growing up, Gary? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. All right. Andy, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, I'll defer to the economist, but my sense is that there was a fairly significant shift in the American labor market, really starting in the 1960s, but accelerating in the 70s, 80s, and 90s and beyond, where we've gone from where the households were more likely to have a single wage earner, the father, and the mother did stay at home, whereas now you see, particularly in upper, highly educated families, both people working. So while median household incomes have increased, the amount of actual labor that it takes to generate that household income has really gone up. So we've got a lot of two family working households rather than single family working households, and I think that's one of the reasons that some of the stresses that you see in the middle class have increased, because now you have to juggle not only your work life and your home life, but two people's work lives and home life.
Here's the flip side of that point, and thank you for the call, Gary. And Dennis, I'll throw this to you. The flip side of that is, okay, way back when Gary grew up and I grew up, and I suspect you gentlemen grew up, the definition of middle class perhaps was different. People had just one car. They had a much smaller house. Our houses have gotten bigger. And they certainly didn't have, you know, monthly cable bills and, you know, internet bills and iPhone bills and all that stuff. So maybe our standard of mm-hmm. what it takes to maintain that middle class lifestyle has gone up.
Right. Well, it has. It's probably in the last three decades. That median income number I was talking about has risen by about 30%, adjusted for inflation. So, again, our perceptions and our definitions, frankly, of what constitutes a middle-class household have changed.
The stuff you need to have to consider yourself
the stuff you need
class.
To have, and actually the characteristics of the households themselves. In 1971, as for instance, about 74% of the so-called middle-class household or middle-income households were married households with a spouse present. That dropped in 2011 to 55%. And the portion of middle-income households where the individual was never married was about 16% in 1971, increased to 27% in 2011. Now, you see the same kind of movement and changes for all classes. And again, if you're looking at educational attainment, it's much more likely, more than a quarter of the middle-income households have a college education. It was only 10% back in 1971. The point is that you see the same kind of movement in low-income households as defined. You see the same kind of movement in high-income households as defined. And really, I think it speaks more to the structure of our society, the fact that educational attainment has been increasing. Households are much more likely to be non-traditional in the way that we currently think of it. And that, I think, gets tied up with the and sometimes confused, frankly, with the middle income discussion.
What do you think, Charlie, of Gary's point and the point that I brought up, too?
I think that the phenomenon that Gary Hinsett and that you're talking about, began in the 1970s to a large extent. If you look at houses people lived at in the 1960s, they're dramatically smaller. My dad used to every few Sundays or so would take us on a tour throughout Metro Detroit. I grew up in Detroit, of every house he'd ever lived in. So I can tell you sort of where they are, though half of them I wouldn't drive by anymore. And what struck me about some of them is how tiny they were. And they weren't really tiny. They just seemed tiny to us because, you know, back then it seemed fine. So you had a 10 by 10 bedroom. That wasn't that big a deal.
Everybody
didn't have their own bathroom. And you shared bathrooms. And what was the big deal about that? And by the way, everybody didn't have a cell phone. And what are the costs of all those things? Look at your cell phone bill someday and say you didn't have that. How many nights a week do people eat out? And this is sort of one of my favorite stories that I drive my wife with crazy with constantly because I constantly repeat it. Hamburger Helper. So if you look at commercials for a Hamburger Helper, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, it was about when you don't feel like cooking tonight, Hamburger Helper. And then, you know, the little guy with the oven mitt was still there, and it was a great commercial and all that. The same commercial today, same guy with the oven mitt, the same product. Only now it's not when you don't feel like cooking. It's when you feel like homemade. So we've gone from a period where that was the one edge of what you might have for dinner. That was the easy edge. Now that's the involved edge of what you have for dinner. People go out to eat more. People have more cell phones. People have more everything today. And so I think that's also a big part of it.
Wow. Hamburger Helper as a social and economic indicator. That's
my
first,
favorite
Charlie.
Thing.
I like that, too.
Let's go back to the callers. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Beth is waiting in Stratford. Hi, Beth. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We definitely feel part of the beleaguered middle class. We both work outside the home. We have three teenage boys. And when we bought our first home back in 1998, 4 years later when we sold it, we made a 90% profit. Today, we bought our home in 2003, and it's worth less than the day we bought it.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good, does it, Beth?
No, and we dutifully fill out the FAFSA for college, and they give you an amount that they tell you is your expected family contribution. But financial aid comes to about twice that. So if you're expected to pay $10,000, you'll be lucky if financial aid meets. You know, you'll still owe $20,000 to $25,000.
So you're not rich enough to afford it on your own, but you're not poor enough to get a lot of financial aid, Beth. Is that where you're at?
Not exactly. Not even close.
Yeah.
And that's not even including the fact of how much our health care has gone up. So our real income over the last decade has dropped significantly.
Your real income after all those expenses. Beth, thank you for calling. Got a question for you, Andy, but you first, Dennis, the economics that Beth is talking about.
Well, again, that it's another example of stress on that everybody's feeling, frankly, whether you're lower self-identified lower class or middle class or high class. I mean, healthcare costs are taking a bigger and bigger bite out of the economy generally. We're up to about 25% or so of economic activity is directed towards healthcare expenditures, education expenditures. Again, as Beth was pointing out, I'm going through somewhat the same thing myself. I have a daughter who's a senior now at Ohio State University, and it's it's difficult to put together the package that will keep her there. But the other side of that is we know we have to do these things. I mean, we know that we. We want to stay healthy. We want to improve our quality of life. We want to improve our longevity. And we also know that, getting a college education for our kids or increasing educational attainment, not everybody has to go to college, certainly, but increasing your knowledge and skill in the workforce is a ticket to better earnings in the future.
Yeah, well, Beth, thanks for calling in, and good luck to you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about the middle class and all the talk about how beleaguered it is these days. Also, how the candidates are talking a lot about middle class struggles. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. www.pewresearch.org. And Andy Smith, another question for you. We talked earlier about the Pew Research study about the lost decade of the middle class. Pew also asked middle-income people who they blame for the difficulties they've faced. And here's who they blame the most. Congress, 62%. Banks and financial institutions, 54%. Large corporations, 47%. And then after that, it was the Bush administration, foreign competition, the Obama administration. 8% said middle class people themselves are partly to blame for their struggles. What do you make of that, Andy?
Not too surprising. First off, everybody likes to blame Congress. They're the least popular branch of government, have been so for decades.
Easy target.
They're an easy target. But I think you're right. When the economy's bad and people lose their jobs or they're concerned about losing their jobs and their houses are underwater, they think that there are forces out there that are beyond their control. And when you're in that sort of situation, you're looking around for somebody to blame for the problems that you're in. And one of the things that we don't look at, and what's at the bottom of your list, is the middle class themselves. I think a lot of us have gotten into the position that when the economy's gone down and we've been in a position of losing our jobs, that we weren't prepared, that we didn't put enough money away, we didn't save as much, we got expenses that are beyond what we can reasonably carry. And I think that's a more significant problem because it says something about how we live our lives and how we expect things to go than some of the other things. But it's, to me, the institutions that are getting blamed, it's not too surprising.
Yeah, what do you think, Charlie?
Well, it's always nice to blame somebody else, and Congress is a nice amorphous blob that's easy to blame because they're a bunch of pinheads. that's my general attitude. Not the individuals, of course. Any congressman listening should not feel that remark was directed to him or her. To some extent, what happens is we go through a period of time and we assume that's the new normal and that will happen for the rest of our lives. For a couple of generations ago, it was the Great Depression. They went through the Depression and they assumed that that was the normal or possible, and it led them to make changes to the way they lived, to not take things for granted. And what it generally meant is they had a lot more savings than the rest of us do today because they were always worried about losing everything. Most of us who are, you know, in our age bracket, so I'm 47, I'm born in 1965, and, you know, I haven't gone through periods of tremendous stress. I mean, I felt like I was out of work for a while and I felt very stressed, but at the end of the day, you know, no. I mean, we've lived in our house for 20 years and have never been threatened realistically with foreclosure and everything like that. So we go through a new normal. So for example, the last caller had a period of time where her house increased by 90%. In about 5 years. And that's a wonderful thing, and it's rare. If you catch the right 5 years, that happens. Unfortunately, right now she caught the wrong 10 years, and it's going the other direction. The average of that is more likely, but, you know, if you're on the wrong side of average, you feel terrible. But we get used to one thing, and it has to change.
All right. Well, more conversation after a short break. Thanks for those calls. We'll take more of your calls in just a minute. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. You can post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. I also have a couple emails I want to share with you, gentlemen. So more of that when we come back.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank. Trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs and themerrimack.com. And from SIT Graduate Institute, offering internationally focused master's degree programs, hosting an open house at the Brattleboro campus on October 19th. Information at sit.edu. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Hi there, I'm Virginia Prescott. NHPR is kicking off our fall fun drive with the Perfect 10 Power Morning. That's our effort to squish a day's worth of fundraising, $70,000, into just 4 hours. When we hit our goal by 10 a.m. on October 10th, that's 10-10, the rest of the day will be fundraising free. Become a sustaining member of NHPR for just $10 a month when you make a donation online at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how the middle class is faring and how it's being portrayed this political season. Join us. What do you make of all the conversation about a beleaguered middle class, the so-called lost decade of the middle class. Does this reflect your reality or not? Do you think middle class problems are getting enough attention from our elected leaders or too much attention? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Charlie Arlinghouse, Dennis DeLay, Andy Smith, before we go back to our listeners, here's an email that came in from Les in Brattleboro. And Dennis, I think this is for you. He says, what role, if any, does unchecked globalization and the global movement of cheap labor play in the sharp decrease in living standards of so many people in the U.S.?
That's an interesting question because I'm not sure the two things follow one to the other.
I think that good manufacturing jobs and some high-tech jobs and call centers and all these jobs have been outsourced to China and India. I've got a friend who used to work in high-tech. That job, white collar,
right.
got outsourced,
yeah.
so he became a lawyer. That's mm-hmm. not going to be outsourced. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think that's what Les is getting at.
Well, no, I understand that. I mean, I think what economists, we like to talk about what's seen and what's unseen. Okay, so the seen thing is that, as I said earlier, there's been a decline in manufacturing jobs both nationally and here in New Hampshire. And some of that is – actually, most of that is due to technology changes. In other words, it's not that jobs have moved to India or to China as much as it is changes in productivity and capital investment at manufacturing firms that make the average worker more productive. So in that sense, those jobs didn't really go anywhere, and therefore they're not coming back either. Even that's another thing that we talk about. So that's the seen thing. The unseen thing is the fact that we get much more cost-competitive products, manufactured goods, even some services, because those goods are being made where not only labor costs but also raw materials costs are a lot lower than they are here. As an example, there are and I like to use this sort of my hamburger helper example. I like to use this a lot and had heard this a few years ago. Do you know that there are no televisions made in the U.S. any
longer? I did
know
that, yes.
Okay. But how many televisions do you have in your house?
Well, I have just one, but I think I'm unusual.
Well, I have about four of them. So the point is that even though we don't make a product any longer, it doesn't mean that it's not accessible and it's not a lot more affordable than the same product would have been, say, two decades ago.
Well, Les, thanks for the email. And gentlemen, let's go back to our callers. The number 1-800-892-6477. Cliff is waiting in Ware. Hi, Cliff. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I just wanted to have them address the disproportionate way that the economy affects the middle class. I think it makes it more the target of any type of changes that the government or the economy pushes forward. If the rich people are taxed more, they find ways of passing on the costs, and it always falls on the middle class. The economy goes down. They find ways of getting rid of jobs. It all falls on the middle class. So the emphasis on the middle class, I think, is totally appropriate. We're the ones that always catch everything.
All right. Cliff, thanks for the call. What do you think, Andy Smith?
Well, there is something to that. Certainly the upper income people do pay a higher percentage of taxes, but when then do people down the road, there's different ways of looking at it, but the highest 1 or 2% of wage earners in the country pay upwards of 40% or so of all of our income taxes. But I think what his bigger point is, though, if you're wealthy, you can afford to pay some additional monies, or if you lose your job or your business goes south, you've got a nice financial cushion there. If you're really low income and are getting government subsidies either through food stamps or Medicaid or other subsidies, when the economy's bad, well, you're frankly already not doing so well anyway, and you're getting subsidized. It's the people in the middle who don't have the benefit of the subsidies particularly, and they don't have the benefit of the economic cushion, the financial cushion at the top, that are going to feel more squeezed.
Cliff, thanks for the call. And here's the flip side of what he says. Charlie, and I'll throw this to you. Scott Winship of the Brookings Institution wrote an article in the New Republic that says this is kind of the opposite of what Cliff says. He says, stop feeling sorry for the middle class. They're doing just fine. Winship says, this is his view, that candidates are pandering to this group, that their problems have been overstated, and that instead we should be devoting attention and scarce resources for the truly needy. Again, I'm quoting him here. What do you think?
Well, whether I'm needy or not is sort of the eye of the beholder. My reaction to the caller initially was, well, it's not the middle class that get hit first. It's the lower class, the working class, the people who are struggling more so than they are. And it ties into that notion about who's middle class and who isn't. So who gets impacted first? Well, it's probably not the people who are in the upper, you know, the top 4 or 5%. Yeah, they're doing fine anyway. I think one of the candidates in a debate recently said something like, doesn't really matter who wins the election to them, that, you know, they're okay either way. But it does matter for the middle class, but it particularly matters for lower middle class, people who are unemployed, people who are looking for a job. The people who are most affected by whether jobs go away or come back are the people who are unemployed. And it's not the people who are middle class. It's the people who are struggling to get by. It's single mothers. It's people like that. So, you know, we need to think a little bit about how our economic choices affect them as well, and not so much. I mean, we need to affect how they affect everybody. But there are some people who are in their upper middle class who are probably cry woe is me a little bit more than they ought to.
Well, and the idea that we hear about local food pantries really still seeing increases and so forth. Homeless shelters definitely don't have a lot of vacancies.
Yeah, no, that's the big issue. And it's hard to think that people who are homeless are less affected than the middle class.
What do you think about that, Dennis, real quickly? And then I have another question for you. Again, Scott Winship saying, hey, stop feeling sorry for the middle class. They're doing fine.
Well, again, actually, Scott and a couple of other researchers for the Brookings Institution did another study looking at the progression of people as they, you know, enter young adulthood and enter the working, you know, into the working environment and reach middle age into old age, you know, how likely they are to get into the middle class as we've defined it. And it's about 2 out of 3 Americans are able to achieve a middle class lifestyle by middle age, they found. And again, what has to happen, though, is there are a series of hurdles that you have to get over, or tests that you have to pass, or whatever. When you're young, it's, you know, if you have any trouble with law enforcement, or if you have, or if you come from a lower income family, you're a lot less likely to make that progression to a middle class lifestyle by the time you're middle age. Things like family wealth matter a lot as well. So, again, you know, I think this society actually is a lot more mobile, and there's a lot more movement in and out of these, you know, narrowly defined groups that we've been talking about than people tend to admit. I mean, people that are in lower income will move up to middle income. People that have had a lot of money, and there's some notable ones that we can think about when we think about corporate malfeasance and that type of thing, you know, can fall pretty rapidly as well.
You gave us some numbers at the outset of the program, Dennis, that said while the middle class is shrinking, you might look at that and go, ooh, that's bad news. Some of those folks had moved up, and some of them had moved down.
Yeah, again, maybe according to the Pew Research study, about 6% or so moved from the middle class to the upper class, and about 4% or so moved from the middle class to the lower income classes.
Charlie?
It's a big point about American society in general is that there's a great deal of mobility here, and studies have been clear on this for 20 or 30 years, where whether it's Brookings or the Urban Institute has done studies on this as well, about people's ability to move from even the lowest quintile to the highest quintile, and the surprising degree of people who do that. So when we think of a lot of these average economic statistics, the average for this group in, you know, 1990 and the average for this group in 2000 don't include the same people. It's not the average for the same 14 million people, because people have moved out into different groups. It is the wonderful thing about American society, as opposed to if you think of 50 or 60 years ago, European societies, where you stayed somewhere. You know, you got a job and, you know, people were watching, like, you know, upstairs, downstairs or something, or people in service, and they stay in that job for 40 years. And that doesn't happen. And in America today, nobody stays in the same.
It's a lot more mobility.
There's a huge amount of mobility.
Andy, one last quick question for you on this, and then I'm going to go back to our callers. What do you think about this statement by Scott Winship? It stirred up a lot of controversy among researchers who look at class and income and mobility and so forth.
Well, you know, I think both Charlie and Dennis have talked about it, that, you know, where you are depends on what your perception is. And the perceptions are important. There's some criticisms of Winship's analysis by people saying that, you know, they picked the wrong dates, and if they would have picked different decades, they would have gotten different results. But I think that's more methodological nitpicking, and the perception is important.
What about the pandering idea, though? That he says, well, candidates are pandering to these folks, you know?
Well, the politicians pandering isn't a surprising thing. That's kind of their job description, is what they're supposed to do, is pander for votes. And again, getting back to my very first point, in the middle class is where the votes are. So it's, you know, you would expect them to pander to that particular group. So I'm not particularly surprised. And as you can see, that's, as Charlie pointed out too, this isn't new in American politics. This is where politicians typically go, because not only are more people in the middle class, actually, more people actually consider themselves in the middle class.
Take another call. This is from Concord, Vermont, and Paul's on the air. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. I have two comments, but I also have a quick comment to the conversation you just had. I've been reading a lot of articles that say, in fact, quote, five recent studies that say the United States to be much less mobile than comparable nations. There's a project led by Marcus Jannetty, an economist at a Swedish university, that found that 42% of American men raised and the bottom fifth of income stay there as adults. But the other comment I wanted to respond to, there was a question about where to place blame, and one of the responses was, well, and there's true, we all have individual responsibilities, but the comment was, you know, a lot of people have bought more than they need to. That has to be said in the context that we live in a system that, for example, the economics, the corporations spend billions of dollars to tell us that we need to buy more. And in fact, one of the measures we look at as we're trying to get out of bad economic times is how much consumption is happening. And the third point that I want to make is that the reality of, in many ways, how the middle class was built in this country. And I remember a few weeks ago or a month or two ago, you had some members of the Tea Party on, and I tried to get on the program because I wanted to ask them. They talk about where they want to take, they talk about we want to take America back. And for me, that implies that we want to take it back to some place. And I've had this conversation with some people, and I suspect that I knew the answer. And the answer I almost always got was, we want to take it back to the late 50s. Well, if we look at the late 50s, we're coming out of the GI Bill, and we're coming out of a time between 1933 and 1964, there was $120 billion in federal housing subsidies from the FHA that built the middle class. And the final point I want to make about that, which relates directly to my work, is how racialized that was, because of that $120 billion, about 98.6% of it went to white people.
You know, lots and lots of thoughts here, Paul, and I appreciate the call. Wow, I'm not really sure where to start, except maybe, Charlie, with his first point. He's seen research, and I have too, Paul, showing that there's actually less class mobility than we used to have.
I think there's probably less mobility than we used to have, and that does go up and down. And I've seen the Swedish study, and I've seen some criticisms of it as well. And you know, it's one of those things when you talk about economic studies, I would you're never sure exactly who to believe. And I'd encourage people who are interested in the subject to go read them all. I just think in general that we know that in, you know, the American society, which is to some extent even pervading Europe now, does allow a great deal of more opportunity like that. It is true that at some levels it doesn't happen as much. I do want to address the notion of taking us back to the 1950s. There are probably people who think that, and I think that, but I think that's a caricature of a lot of us, that there may be aspects of the 1950s that we like, but nobody thinks that the racial attitudes of the 1950s are worth replicating. Even the people who are accused of having a, I mean, let's use, you know, I don't, well, I'm going to not use that because that's a political example, but there are, for example, politicians who are accused of being racially motivated, who nonetheless either marched themselves or whose parents marched themselves in the civil rights marches of the 1960s. And so I think that we may look at things about that. I mean, I want to, in terms of income growth, I want to take us back to the 1990s where we had strong income growth. In terms of housing going up, I want to take us back to the early part of the 2000s, although a little bit more muted perhaps. In terms of, so there are things that I want to take us back to and by moving forward. And I think that, you know, we look at things and what do we want? We want more jobs. We want more jobs accessible to more people. And we want so that they can climb out of whichever income quintile they're in up into the next one.
Well, you know, Dennis and Andy, maybe I'll go to you next, Andy. This idea of the 1950s and Charlie's point about there are different parts of different decades that we like. There is an impression, though, Andy, that in the 1950s, you did have this growing, solid, prosperous middle class.
Yeah, we had a growing, prosperous middle class and a big, dynamic manufacturing industry, largely because we had pretty much destroyed the rest of the world's economic capacity during the Second World War. We were exporting so much to the rest of the world because nobody had any infrastructure that they could build things themselves. So, yeah, we had a really good economic decade in the 1950s and 1960s, but that's more of an accident of history than it was due to specific policies. The same is true with the housing and so forth that the caller talked about, that, you know, we had a lot of housing that was built in that era, and it was certainly some of it encouraged by the federal government, but a lot of it was there because people had money that they were getting from the rest of the world. The perceptions are important. That is the bigger issue. It's, today, the problem is where people think they are and where they ought to be, and people right now just aren't thinking very good about it. If I want to just throw a couple statistics out from some of the numbers that we've looked at, I went back to before the 2004 election, so like the peak of consumer confidence in New Hampshire, and looking at it today. There is a real perception among middle class folks. This is people with about $50,000 to $100,000 income in New Hampshire, that their households are worse off than they were a year ago, and they don't expect them to be better off a year from now. So the perception is there. It doesn't so much matter whether that's real, but it's the perception that people act on.
All right. Well, Andy, thank you very much for giving your time. I know this is a busy season for you, so thanks a lot for being
with us.
Thank you. Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center and an associate professor of political science at UNH. Dennis DeLay, good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Great to be here. Thank you, Laura.
Dennis DeLay, economist for the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies and New Hampshire forecast manager for the New England Economic Partnership. And Charlie Arlinghouse, thank you also for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie Arlinghouse, president of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, a free market think tank based in Concord. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Priscilla Malcolm. And our volunteer is also Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. You can learn more about upcoming shows, what we're planning, get extra links and material. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.